was a shock. Yes, it was a big shock. You come from a warm, tropical, sunny, beautiful climate right along the beach of Tel Aviv. And you come here in December, which means winter is just starting in Chicago. And it's like, what is going on? It is gray. It is cold. It is dingy. It's not fun. And I'm no longer running around in my shorts and my tank top and sandals, which I did every day, coming back from school and going running out with my friends. And yeah, it was a shock and it was depressing.
Was it?
Extremely.
How old were you that time?
11.
11.
I turned 11 on the boat between the port of Haifa, Israel, and Cyprus.
How interesting.
We took a boat, a cruise boat, actually, through the Mediterranean. We stopped off in Cyprus, then we stopped off in Piraeus, Greece. Then we spent a few hours there, so we hired a taxi driver to take us to the ruins of the Acropolis, and we saw that, and that was kind of exciting. It was fun. And then we boarded back on a boat. Then we sailed to Genoa, Italy. And then we abandoned the boat. We literally abandoned the boat in Italy and had lunch there. And even though I was only 11, I realized how beautiful the Italian women were. And they were quite nice, everybody. And yeah, the lira was like $1 million for a loaf of bread. So they had hyperinflation over there. And I noticed that. And then from Italy, which again, it was like brick streets and so everything was pretty. We somehow got on a train. And I remember we were late to the train and this poor woman in a little car heard my dad asking the gas attendant about the train station. She's like, oh my God, you're going to miss it. You're going to miss it. The next one is 6 hours later. Get in my car. Get in my car. I'll drive you there. And she sped off in her little gas thing that comes off to put gas broke off because she sped off, the poor girl. And she got us there. And we were like 10 minutes late. And we had to sit in the train station for like 6 hours for the next train.
Wow. So you were waiting for the next train?
Yeah, that was miserable. And we waited and then we took a train. We went through Switzerland, maybe part of France. That was the first time I saw snow looking outside of the window of the train as night fell. And I'm like, wow, cool. We ended up in... I think Switzerland. No, we end up in Luxembourg. The little country of Luxembourg. The first time I saw a squirrel, it was a red squirrel, it was in Switzerland. And that's where I think the train was. It's kind of sketchy to me. But then we took an airplane from Luxembourg, from there to Iceland. My dad says, oh, I got to go out to smoke a cigarette. He came back within 2 minutes, he goes, oh my God, it's freezing out there. Forget it. So he came back in and we flew to New York, from New York to Chicago. It was like it took us 5 days.
What a journey. What a journey. I think I've never heard such a long journey of immigrating to anywhere, actually, not just the United States.
You know, why we did that.
Yeah, that's the biggest question.
I kind of forgot the question, the answer. My dad passed away 10 years ago, but I can ask my mom. I think she'll be able to give me some sort of an answer.
Sure.
I believe that my dad ran away from Israel. He couldn't announce that he's leaving. I think he ran away. Maybe he owed taxes or something, because I know he owed taxes. He was self-employed. So there was something funky there. That's what we had to do that way. Although I don't think it was too funky because he went back to visit about 6 years later. And it's not like the authorities, you know, handcuffed him or something. Like, okay.
Right.
Now we got you, you know. Yeah. So I'm not quite sure. I'll have to ask my mom next time I talk to her.
That would be interesting to hear the answer. I'm really curious to know. And when you were talking about taking a boat and going by water, in my head, I have those pictures of people immigrating back in the 19th century, taking a boat, especially Jewish people. I know that quite a lot of Jewish people from Russia immigrated this way. And you represent actually the culture. It's just interesting. That's what I have in my head right now.
If I knew how, and because I'm not that, as you can see now, not so technically inclined, I would scroll to my photos and there's a picture of me, age 11, coming down the metal stairs from the boat, walking down. It's actually an adorable picture. I was told I should frame it. A sweater that my mom knitted, the leather coat that they bought me, they thought it would be warm for Chicago, which was not. And there's a picture of me walking down. As a matter of fact, we're having dinner on the boat. It was either the first or I think it might have been the second night. So my birthday is December 14th. We got here December 19th in Chicago. So it took 5 days. So it might have been the first. All of a sudden, I hear like little music and there's a cake, a small little chocolate cake put on a table. And they sang happy birthday to me. So I guess
you didn't expect that, or you were surprised?
I was surprised.
Okay.
I was totally surprised. And my parents, I guess, told the servers, and they were nice enough to do that. I'm like, oh, cool.
That's very nice that they thought of that. They wanted to create this memory for you. They didn't want to miss this birthday for you.
Yeah.
It's very special. Now you can share your special birthday. You turned 11 between two countries. Isn't that fascinating? It's just very unique. And the childhood memories, as we know, they're very big and they're very important in our adult life as well. And looking at you, how you talk about this sweater my mom made for you, and you thought it's going to be warm for Chicago winter in December. Good luck.
We had no gloves, no hats, By the way, one thing I should tell you, my parents arranged for green cards for all of us. So we had green cards coming here. We didn't just come here, we'll figure it out like a lot of people, especially these days. But back then, it had to be legitimate. My dad had an extensive conversation with his cousin who visited Tel Aviv many years ago. I remember as a little kid watching them talk. I'm like, what are they talking about? And afterwards, I asked my mom, and she's like, he was talking to Perry, his cousin Perry, about moving to the United States, if he can help him. So we may be moving. My parents first thought they would go to South Africa. A lot of Israelis moved there. They thought that always that life is better somewhere else for some reason.
Right.
It took 2 years to arrange for a green card, to be sponsored. We had to be sponsored, We had to prove we're legitimate and we will contribute to society, so forth and so on. Absolutely. And I remember all of a sudden I'm in class in Israel. Also, my mom, I was like yanked out, like, okay, we're moving. I'm like, what? Yeah, we got the green cards. We're moving to America. Just like that. It was so matter of fact. It was not anything, like
negotiable or
it was just like an everyday occurrence, like, okay, we're moving. Okay. I left the class, didn't say goodbye to anybody. And
you were in school when?
Yeah, yes.
Oh, okay.
My mom came and yanked me out of school midday. Just like that. It was so matter of fact. And we went to my grandmother's place, that day, the day after, whatever. I don't know what it was. And we stayed there all day long. And my grandma, my grandfather was there, my aunt and her little baby boy, who I adored to no end. He was one. And my two favorite uncles were there. And we were there for hours. Taxi came in the afternoon, took the four of us. My two uncles came in a different taxi. We went to the port city of Haifa. They both of them sat with us. Both of them got on the boat with us. Wow. My Uncle Nathan, my favorite, I saw his eyes were watery, very watery, but he wouldn't cry because he was a tough guy. And he was very, very emotional. I could tell. I'm looking at him. And then all of a sudden the boat started moving, like, oh, damn. They started running full speed.
That's like the reality, Olympians, yeah.
Down the deck. And then back then it was just a board connecting the entrance of the boat to the dock, you know. And the board was off. They actually leaped off the boat onto the concrete, you know, on a port. They would have missed it if it was like 20 seconds later. That was good.
Totally a movie there. Scene. Everything you are saying, I saw in the movies.
Didn't see him until 12 years later when I went to Israel for the first time to visit. So yeah, then we got here and it was cold and dingy and disgusting. My brother and I were bored to death. We didn't know what to do. We were dying for some board game or whatever. So I said to my mom, please, can you just take us to a store to buy a board game so we can play? Because I didn't speak English. You didn't understand anything on TV. And yeah, and so we went out. And after walking a few blocks, you're freezing to death.
And I think it's very symbolic that you are sharing your story today on My American Dream podcast when it's prime time for Chicago winter. It's snowing very heavily, right. And you are sharing your story.
Yes, true.
It's so interesting. I'm a strong believer that everything happens for the reason in life. But holding the thought and coming back when you were talking about your mom coming to school and just saying, okay, we're going to the United States. Did you get a chance to pack your favorite things from home and bring with you to the United States?
We had no favorite things. We were so poor. And I'm saying it as a very serious thing. That sounds like a joke, but we had nothing. We had nothing electronics. It's not even electronic. The only thing we had that was like a gadget was a transistor radio that my dad brought on one of his trips to Cyprus, you know, that he took by himself when he lived in Israel. He brought back a transistor radio and it was, oh my God, it's such a big deal. Look at this thing, you know. It was really exciting.
It was.
But otherwise, no, we had nothing. We had, and we're happy. Nobody felt deprived. It's not like, oh, we're poor. Oh my God, life is terrible. Not at all. I got my brother's clothes, hand-me-downs. He's 3+ years older. And that was fine. My mom would go to the old market and the guy would look at my foot and then he would take some leather and sole and nails and make me a pair of shoes. I'm watching him make me a pair of shoes. He didn't go to the store because he couldn't afford the shoes at a fancy store on Allenby Street in Tel Aviv. So we went to the Sandlar, which is the guy who makes the shoes and sandals, and he'd make it right there.
Interesting.
I'd see him cut the leather, nail the nails, put the heels on, just that's how it was, you know. Simple life, very, very simple, but joyful. I'm glad I was not born wealthy.
Interesting. Why do
everything
you
had
say
to be
so?
Earned. Everything had to be earned. Everything. I have a friend, I don't see him much more anymore, but he's kind of like my age, maybe a little older, about my two sons' age. And he kind of struggled also at the beginning, but did very well and did everything for his two sons. And I said to him, I said, let me ask you a question. Who's better off, you or me, who struggled as young people and really had to earn and fend for ourselves, or our two sons who we could give everything to, and we did? I said, who's better off? He goes, and he sat there and thought about it. He goes, you know what? You're right. I think we're better off. I said, I do too. I said,
it's
I do too. So yeah, it was no complaints. So we had nothing to pack up memories, you know. It was clothes. Clothing and whatever mom, you know, my dad was a jeweler. So my mom had some nice jewelry that he made her over the years. And that was key. We came here with zero money. My dad had $120 in a bank, literally $120. Those are savings. And I think my dad then was like 41 and my mom was like 38, if, you know, within a year or so. And I remember we stayed with family the first few weeks. He was like dying for the money to be wired, because that $120 was like all the whole world to him. Finally, he got it and he was relieved, I remember. And we're kind of bounced from one family place to another. And it's like, hey, you got to find your own place. And one of our we have relatives here, but they're very distant relatives. They're not like, you know, cousins or whatever. They somehow were related. Don't ask me how. Through great grandparents, whatever, you know. And they're all very nice and helpful, I have to admit. I'm not so sure my dad appreciated them. And when I saw them later on in the years, I told him, you know, if you don't think you were appreciated properly back then, I just want you to know, from my perspective, you're very much appreciated. And I, even though I was a little boy, I saw all the efforts on your part that you did on our behalf that you didn't need to, you know, it's like volunteer, but you did. And I'm acknowledging it and telling you that it was noticed, you know, on my part. Yeah, I felt kind of bad because like they should have been recognized a little more. So yeah, we finally found an apartment in Rogers Park, East Rogers Park.
In Chicago.
My brother and I always shared a bedroom. And then it was time to register to school. I was in sixth grade. And luckily when we left, I started sixth grade in Israel. And in sixth grade in Israel is when they started teaching you English. They didn't teach you English in grade school in fifth, fourth. Now they do. They start first grade. But back then, they started in sixth grade. So school started August, September. We left December. So at least I learned the alphabet. I didn't know any language, but I knew the alphabet. I knew A, B, C, D. So I knew how to pronounce each letter, which was important for me. So when it came to sign me up for school for sixth grade, then they're like, they're looking at me and they're like, well, we should put him down to fifth grade so he can acclimate. It'll take him a while to acclimate. And I said to my mom, no. I'm not losing a year of my life. I want to start sixth grade here. I know it's going to be a struggle, but you tell him that. So then she said to our translator, you know, it's like there's two translators. I told my mom in Hebrew. She told this guy that took us there, also a family member, Solomon Michael, God rest his soul. And he told them, the office, like, look, the kid says blah, blah, blah. And they're like, all right, tell you what, we'll try him out in sixth grade, but if his grades are not there, we see him struggling, we're putting him right to fifth grade. Now, if there's any incentive to do well in school, that was the incentive. And even though I failed every class, every grade in Israel, because I was kind of punky, and I don't want to say not well-behaved, but I just didn't focus on school. And I had horrible grades. And the teachers didn't like me. It was you know, it was what it was, okay? They told the good students not to hang around with me because I'm a bad influence. They literally said that, and I heard them say that. And I'm like, why do you say that? That's so hurtful. I'm a good boy. Why do you say I'm a bad influence? I'm thinking, that's not nice, you know?
Because you don't realize these things. You don't see yourself from the outside.
No, exactly. But they saw me that way. So I'm like, okay, I better get my stuff together here. So I started studying for the first time in my life. I hit the books and I tried reading. And I remember asking my brother was already in high school, which was very rough for him, because right away you go to high school in a different country. It's cruel to no end, because the peer pressure in high school, we all know it's terrible. So he helped me a little bit, and I started getting decent grades. I'm like, wow, this is cool. This feels good. It's like eating popcorn. You can't eat just one. You know, you got to eat the whole bag. And once you get good grades, you don't want to go back. You want to continue because it feels good. And I did well, and the teachers were impressed. As a matter of fact, it's almost like a God sent an angel to me. So Mr. Wahlberg was a social studies teacher, and he says, I speak Hebrew fluently. I said, you do? He said, yes. He goes, school starts at 8. You show up here at 7 a.m. every morning, and I'll teach you English.
There is something that I want to revisit because it blew me away.
Yeah.
As a person who follows some influencers in this country, and this is one of the stories that you can hear from them. And this is how American Dream happens.
Wait, America what?
American Dream happens this way.
American Dream happens.
You said that you started, when we were talking about careers, you mentioned yours. And you said that you started as a bank employee.
Yes. Well, what happened was, okay, graduated high school, went to University of Illinois Chicago. It was called Chicago Circle back then on a near south side, because that's all I could afford. And I commuted from home, no dorms, no partying, no nothing. It was about getting an education, unlike today. I studied business administration. I graduated within 3 years. Graduated and got married with a week later after I got my degree. And we won't go into the details there, just that's what it was. My wife then, ex-wife now, was Jewish, lived in Israel for a number of years, spoke Hebrew, and the culture was very attractive to me, you know, the commonality. Anyway, so I finished and I got a business degree. I couldn't get a job because I was still like 19 when I graduated, I think, and nobody would hire me. But the Israeli bank that was suggested to me go apply over there. I went, talked to the manager, begged him for a job. And he's like, you know, you're a cool guy, but you're so young, you know. But
how old was young?
I was either 19 or 20.
You were young.
Yeah. I think I was still 19 because I think he said that to me. But anyway, so he, but then somebody, I think, made a phone call to him and said, look, you know, I know the family is a good boy, da, da, da. You should hire him. So he did. He did. I got $9,600 a year in salary, and I was the happiest guy in the world because I had a job. I mean, through college, I worked in a suit, exclusive men's suit store in Lincolnwood, a very high-end suit store. And I was a stock boy. Then I sold clothing, and that taught me behavior and dress. When you work for a place like that, you have to dress nice, look nice, and behave nice, because the people that came to shop there were high-end people. You couldn't be a jerk, you know. So I learned salesmanship. I learned to relate and all that. Those are an education as well. So I did that through my college years, and that's how I paid for my tuition. So I got hired at the bank, and I was so happy because I had a job, and my wife worked for Allstate. And we rented a unit in Des Plaines by Main East High School, if anybody knows the area there. And I worked there for 5 years. And the bank is right in the corner, was right in the corner of Washington and LaSalle, right across City Hall. So you can imagine the hustle and bustle all day long. And who walks into the bank? Well, you know, a lot of lawyers and professional people. So you learn to be part of that system. And you learn how to relate to them. And as a bank, you're in a service industry. So you got to just take direction, you know, and take care of people. And I developed a very, very good reputation as a person and as an employee in the eyes of a lot of the customers who are all very successful people. And so those 4.5 to 5 years was a hard working years for very little money, just living month to month, right? And but kind of like planting the seeds to the rest of my life, because during that tenure, my friend who worked at the bank as a security guard, and he was Israeli fellow. All the security guards were Israeli fellows that they hired because they were ex-soldiers in Israel and they knew how to handle a gun and all that, right? So he's the one who started asking me questions about my future and so forth. At that point, my little boy was born. He was like 1 year old or something, one and a half. And he's the one who says to me, what are you gonna do with the rest of your life? And, you know, what do you think of the future? I'm like, what are you talking about? What's all this philosophy now about life and so forth? You know, I'm working and this, and that's it. Everything is fine. And he said to me, do you see yourself the same as your manager 20 years from now? And he pointed to my manager at the bank. I'm like, no. So he goes, well, what does that mean? I said, no, I want better. He goes, you want better than that, don't you? I said, yes. He's like, well, why don't you do something about it? I said, well, what do you want me to do? What are you talking about? He goes, get out there and create something for yourself. Become something. I'm like, okay. So, you know, I'm digesting everything that he's saying. I'm not, you know, like, leave me alone. And on a beautiful August summer day, we went for lunch, and he took me to Crocs and Brentano's bookstore and made me buy this book called Think and Grow Rich. It was written in 1941 by Napoleon Hill, which I suggest to everybody. It's a little outdated, but it's still, I think, effective. And I read the book that night, and overnight became a different person. Overnight, everything changed for me. And I mean everything. I went back and he says to me, did you read the book? I'm like, yes. He goes, did you get it? I said, yes, I got it. I'm going to be out of here. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, I'm going to be out of here. I can't do this. This is not the rest of my life. Because he said to me, when he talked to me before that, he says to me, don't you want security? I said, yes, I have security. I have a job here, a steady salary. He goes, no, what you have is insecurity. And I thought about that. What does he mean by that? That I have a steady job, and that's all it is, but it's insecurity. You know. So now fast forward, and I'm telling him, all right, read the book. I'm out of here. He's like, well, what are you talking about? I said, that's it. He goes, well, nobody gets it that fast. You didn't get it. I said, yes, I did. And I read the book 5 times, literally. And I became kind of a different person, a little obsessed, a little crazy, a little... and started planning. So I didn't know what I was going to do. And I kind of, like, somebody said to me something in the financial services area, to be a trader or something like that. They were making big money. But I realized that you have to have capital and money to be in that business. I didn't. So being a financial advisor, stockbroker was another option. So I went that route. And I really believed in myself. It took me a year to make notes and make sure that all of that wonderful reputation that I've established at the bank, all those connections, make sure you've got it all written down. There was no computers back then. Everything is on a pad of paper. And that's going to be your future. That's going to be your future. Those people, you're going to work with them. So, you know, it took me a year, literally, to plan and think and what have you. And I started interviewing at Shearson Lehman, a couple other places, and I was turned down because maybe my interview wasn't so great, maybe I was too young, I don't know. But each time that I was denied, it made me stronger. And there were many secrets in the book, and that was one of them, that if you want success, it ain't gonna happen overnight. You're gonna fail. There's a possibility you're going to fail, but you got to get up, dust yourself off, and move on.
I like what you are saying. I do. Because many people don't do things because they are scared of failure. They don't want to fail. But you are saying that every single failure with my interview made me stronger.
Absolutely.
That's the only way to become stronger, to go through the experience. I can tell you all day how you can become strong, but unless you go there and get the experience, create all these chemical reactions in your brain and neuron connections, you will never get it.
It's part of the process.
Exactly.
Here, I'll give you an analogy. In baseball, if you get 3 hits every 10 at bats, you're batting 300. You're a superstar. You make millions. You failed 7 out of 10 times. Don't forget. Okay?
You failed 7 out of 10 times.
You only succeeded 3 out of 10, and you're a superstar. You know, when you play basketball and you shoot the basketball and you hit 30 to 50%, you're a superstar. That means you failed 5 out of 7 times. You missed. You didn't hit the basket, you know. You didn't score the points. So, you know, that's an analogy. Sports is a great analogy of that.
Totally.
So I will admit that I was turned down, and there was a point where I got a little depressed. I got a little down. I'm like, what's going on here? But God has a mysterious way of working. And the reason I was being turned down, is my last place that I interviewed was with the most wonderful human being that gave me the biggest break of my life, a gentleman by the name of Joe Gennady. He was the manager of Merrill Lynch office in Northbrook. And I went to interview there. And that interview, I came off like a devil, a lion, somebody who's going to attack you if you're not going to go along with me. You better say yes type attitude. And it was 3 interviews. And after the second interview, I think it was, or the last one, he still didn't hire me. And I said to myself, I went home that night, Thursday, and I was literally sick to my stomach. I'm like, if this guy's not going to hire me, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't take no for an answer. I went back Friday. I called the bank. I said, I'm sick. I don't feel good. I'm not coming in. I went back unannounced to his office on Friday. And I was going to march into his office, pound on his table and say, I'm not waiting for Monday for an answer. You give me an answer right now, yes or no. If it's no, you'll never see me again. If it's yes, I'm starting on Monday.
Wow.
So I sat there in the lobby at 9:30 until 11:30. Karen Schaefer, his assistant, finally came out and said, he can't see you. He can't see you. He's busy. I said, well, you tell him I was here. And she said, okay. Monday morning around 8:15, my phone rings in the office at the bank, and it's him. He says, were you here on Friday? I said, yes. I want that job, and I'm not taking no for an answer. That's what I said to him, literally. And he says to me, and he starts chuckling. And he goes, okay, you got it. It's yours. When can you start? I said, tomorrow. He's like, no, give him a 2-week notice. Relax, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. He goes, what do you make over there? So I think I was making then $16,000 a year. So I told him, I was honest, you know. He says, okay, I'll start you at that salary while you're training. I said, no, you won't. You'll pay me $20,000. And he starts laughing.
You're a great negotiator.
He starts laughing. I said, he goes, I'll tell you what. He goes, I'll meet you halfway. I'll pay you $18,000. I said, okay, done. And I said, I'll see you in 2 weeks. And then, yeah, I went. It was Merrill Lynch in Northwick. Now, the reason I say God works in funny ways, then I'm told by some people in the business, like, how did you get into that office? Like, I don't know. I interviewed, got in. Do you not know where that office is, Ron? I'm like, no. It's the number one office at Merrill Lynch in the country. Wow. I said, but there's only 26 brokers. They go, yes. We mean by per man basis. Yes, the office in New York that has 100 brokers does more business, but in a per broker man business, the productivity is number one in the country. You're with superstars all around you. I'm like, really? And they go, yes, you can't get into that office. It's almost a privilege. I'm like, okay, great.
Being naive
sometimes is good because
yes.
you're not moved. You're not like, oh my God. You know,
you don't have this anxiety.
Right. No anxiety. Everything was matter of fact. So I learned in the culture he instilled to the veteran brokers was help the rookies, help the young people, okay? I'll take care of you if you help them. You help them, you're helping me and the office. And they're all too willing to meet with us. It was 4 trainees. I was one of the 4. And they really, really gave us time and knowledge. And I remember saying to myself, I'm gonna become one of these guys, and when I get older and successful like them, I'm going to do the same thing. And I did. And some of these young guys, they're multimillionaires now, in the business and doing and did better than I did, you know, I'm not really much in touch with them, but they know, and I know, and that's what's important, you know? So yeah, you know, the training program was a few months. You had to pass the test. You had to go to Northwestern University to take the test on a Saturday, beautiful Saturday afternoon. I passed it, thank God. I was so scared that I wouldn't pass it because, you know, you get nervous. And as much as you study, you get nervous. You know, I passed, thank God, and we started production. And production basically is picking up the phone and calling people and trying to do business.
Calling guests.
And that's what it was. And, you know, I started, and my first month paycheck was $10,000. I made $10,000 my first month. I'm like, oh my God, really?
When was it? Thinking, what year?
It was in the 80s. It was in the 80s. And I'm like, what? I made $10,000 in 1 month? Really? It took me a whole year to make $16,000. This is ridiculous. You know, so I bought my then wife, who's in a hospital with back issues, a new car. It was $6,000 for a Toyota. And I paid cash and bought her a new car to surprise her or make her happy, to feel better. And then I, every month thereafter, I made money that I dreamed about and thought about and hoped for. And when my wonderful little Adam, the older, became two, that's when life changed. And I was able to buy a single family house. Jason was born a few years later. He was born into a beautiful house, built another house in Northbrook, and the career did very well for me. And the entire thing happened because I read the book Think and Grow Rich. Now, would it happen anyway? I don't know. Maybe. But that really triggered it. And I lived the American dream. I actually did. And surprised a lot of people. I hope I did good with it, you know, to family and friends. Was able to do whatever I could possibly want for my two sons. And that was a pleasure. Because my father gave my brother and I very little. Not because he didn't love us, not because he didn't want to. He didn't have it. It was a laborer working on wages. My mom was a seamstress. You know, they made a salary and they put food on the table. That was it. Their job was to put food on the table, a roof over our head. The rest was up to us. That's how it was in that generation.
And meat, yeah, definitely.
The parents didn't hover all over you. Oh, Little League and this and that. Until today, I have no idea how did I apply for college? How was the paperwork and everything? How did it all happen? You know, because everything was longhand. There was no computers.
Right.
You know, so, but, you know, somehow you figure it out with no help. You know, you're like, throw you into this pool, learn how to swim. You know, so I was able to do a lot of good things for my two sons. And that was a pleasure. That really was.
That's a wonderful feeling.
It really
have this mindset.
And the better feeling is that until today, they know that. They didn't take it for granted.
That's great.
Yeah. Too many kids take things for granted. I showed my two sons the college tuition bill. When I got the bill, which was thousands and thousands of dollars, I showed it to them. I said, here's what I'm paying for your tuition for college. Okay, so my pleasure, but the reason I'm showing it to you is this is what I'm doing for you. Now, there's not much you can do back for me. It's actually, you can't give me anything, you don't have anything, but you can give me one thing back is behave, be a good person, be a good student. Don't take it for granted, you know, apply yourself, you know, and that's how you're going to repay me. And they heard me and they listened. I tell other people, do that. Show your kids what you're doing for them. Quantify it so they appreciate it, you know, and say, wow, you know, don't take it for granted.
Absolutely.
You know, so I have no regrets there, you know, and it was a good times to be in the markets too, because it was kind of a bull market and so forth. A lot of new things started happening. And I tell people today, I still feel like that silly teenage boy running around Rogers Park. You know, it's so weird. All these things have happened to me over the years, but it did. And it's like a dream, you know.
Do you still have your American dream?
Yes. For one reason, reason only, I live very modestly right now, extremely modest, nothing extravagant, okay, at all. And I like it. For me, I'm very happy in my simple, modest life for me. But when success comes to you, you can do a lot for others that you love. So that's, if there's the American dream still in my head, oh, is this, I can do that.
Supporting others.
Provide and help and do for others, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So that gave me, that gives you great pleasure. Right now, I can do a lot for people verbally, talking to them and so forth. You know, I love talking to young people and just kind of share my experiences and what I know and coach them. If they want to listen, fine. If they don't, it's fine. You know, I really do enjoy doing that. And I hope they do listen. So what I give now is my knowledge, you know, my experiences. And I think that's big.
It is. And I think it's one of the unique things in this country is mentorship. And I'm really sad to see that generation of people who have different approach is going. I was at the farewell gathering last Friday for my mentor, David Rosen. He is a big name in this country for technology and adult education. One part of me was sad because he was leaving Lynx. It's a big organization for adult education in this country. But I also saw the extent of his work through those people who gathered and who cheered him and celebrated him. That's why when you say that I like to talk to a younger generation, it's terrific because this is something that they cannot buy. They can't find with their peers. They can hear it from Ron.
Yeah, I had some people suggested to me to get a teacher's assistant, you know, certification so I can, you know, go and I would probably relate well to high school kids. I could probably go and whatever the subject matter is, you know, relate and teach, you know, and gain in high school years. I don't know about younger ones. I love babies just because they're cute and everything and play with what have you. But when it comes to dialogue,
for a while.
I can. I'm very patient with little kids. Everybody knows that. I'm very good with little kids. I think they're adorable as heck, and they're interesting. But you know, to have an actual dialogue, that's high school, even college years. You know, kids right now think they know everything and they don't listen to adults. It's
right.
You know, there's no real advocation of younger people listening to adults. We lost that. And you know, when I was young, and the older one said, I was thinking, now I realize that I'm one of those people now that can bring down knowledge and some experiences and some thought, you know, to the young people. So yeah, I would do that if I was invited. Sure. I mean, one of the things that happened after 2 years being at Merrill Lynch, being in a business, my manager comes in and says, New York called it and wants some hotshot to go to New York to speak to the 200-300 trainees. And they picked you. I'm like, what? Pick me?
What an honor.
I said, from the entire country, they picked me? He goes, yes. I said, okay. But if I go, I lose. You don't make money unless you're in the office because there's no salary. You make commission. So if you're not in the office selling, you're not making money. I'm like, well, I'm going to lose 2-3 days of commission. Are you going to pay me somehow, compensate me? You know, I was very money driven. I'm admitting it. You know, I wanted to make a lot of money, and I wasn't ashamed of it. So he says, listen, I'll set you up at the Plaza Hotel with your wife. My wife was pregnant up to here with my second son, but she came along. And so I went out there, and honestly, I was like 20, I don't know, between 25 and 29 somewhere. And I didn't know what I was doing. I'm like, I'm supposed to speak to, I don't know what I'm going to say. I have no idea, but whatever. They want me to do it, I'll do it. Because he asked me, and he's such a great guy. I told you, the best person that helped me in a career. I'm like, all right, I'll do it. And I got there, and I had to go to this tall building in Manhattan on a 60-something floor. All of them are sitting there in front of me, and I'm on a stage, and all these windows around, and you can see the whole city. It was a real scene. And they're all looking at me. They're all looking at me like I'm supposed to give them all this unbelievable ideas that they can just take with them and become so successful, which is not really going to happen. But you got to say something, you know?
Exactly.
You got to give them something. So I'm like, okay. And I didn't have any notes. I had no notes. Okay. I just, whatever came to my mind, I spoke. So I did it twice, one session in the morning, one in the afternoon. So in the morning, oh boy, did I have them going. I had them going. And one of the things I told them, I said, listen, how many not teachers, I don't know, what do you call me, some instructors, came here and told you how to do it? A lot, right? And I'm one of them. They go, yes, yes. I said, each one of them told you, oh, do it this way. If you do it this way, you'll succeed, right? And they all go, yes, yes. And they're all laughing. I'm like, well, guess what? They're all wrong. Don't listen to them. By the way, Merrill Lynch didn't like that. They didn't like that. You know, the people running training, they didn't like that. I found out
they
later.
Gave you this feedback. They told you that.
No, the manager said, it's like, yeah, they kind of, and by the way, when I went back, the manager's like, what did you do over there? He goes, there's like a huge buzz about you. You know, I'm like, I don't know. So anyway, so I said, they're all wrong in a way. I said, let me explain why. I said, those people are individual people and they have their way. The way they walk, the way they talk, the mannerisms. That's not you. That's them. I'm me. Okay. You're you. We're not the same. Okay. We're just people, but we're different. So the way I speak, the way I look, the way I lean in or lean back or whatever, my mannerisms, you can't emulate that because you're going to look like a robot. You're going to look like somebody that you're copying. And now it looks bad. You look awkward. Be yourself.
And it's not you. It doesn't go with your nature.
And so I said, be natural. Yes. Be who you are. Because at the end of the day, you're selling. When you're a stockbroker, you're selling. And you're really not selling the stock or the investment, you're selling yourself, because nobody knows where the market's going. We don't know if the market's going higher or lower. You know, it's not like we're always going to make them money, because we don't know the future, because that's what the stock market's all about. So at the end of the day, people deal with you because of you, who you are. They like you. Okay. So you have to sell yourself. And I said to them, I said, when you're calling on a phone, when you're looking at somebody, when you're talking to them, just do it your way. Figure out what your way is and come across your way. And so that's true. Natural, and people appreciate that. And they love that. They love that, you know? I could see a sense of relief. And, I mean, I pointed to the window towards the city. And I said to them, look outside. Look outside. And they're all looking. I said, do you know how much money there's out there? Do you have any idea? And they're like, looking. I said, there's millions and trillions and zillions of dollars out there. Go get it. It's yours. Go get it. And they're all like, you know, I mean, I got, you know where I learned that? One of the things, my oldest played basketball, and the coach would say to him, to the players, like, that's your ball. That's not his ball. That's your ball. Go get it. You
know? Exactly.
They're always so aggressive getting the ball as a result. It's like my ball. Hey, what's he doing with my ball? I got to go
and
get
it. And that's true. That's true. When you think about it.
I had him so inspired, apparently. And then after the first meeting, my wife came up to her. She goes, oh my God. She goes, I never seen you like that. It's like she didn't even know who I was. And a couple of the trainees were from my office. And they went back and told the managers, like, oh my God, Ron was on fire. You know, so that was actually not a scary experience. It was a fun experience. I was not as scared to being on stage because I really wanted to share myself and what I know with them. As a matter of fact, in high school, in a junior year, third year, we had a contest. All the high schools had a contest. There were six different contests. Okay, I don't remember the other five, but one of the six was public speaking. So you had to represent your high school, and you had to get up in front of a podium and make a speech. And whoever did that best from his high school won the trophy. Teacher asked me to do that one. It was the only contest that was not a teamwork, it was individual. Nobody wanted to do it. She goes, Ron, you have to do it because I know you can. I'm like, okay, I'll do it for you. So they gave us a subject matter. They gave us 20 minutes to write down a speech. And then you get up and I won. I won a public speaking contest in the city of Chicago.
Surprising from everything you said.
And I was not scared to get up in front. I thought I would be scared to death to get in front of the podium. And when I got to the podium, all of a sudden, this sense of calm came over me. And I rattled off this unbelievable speech. I'm like, where did that come from? Wow. I even impressed myself. And that's when I realized that I can speak in front of an audience and not be scared. Because they're there to listen to me. You know, my oldest is a musician. So is my youngest. He was kind of shy through the years. But when we got on stage, he was a monster. I'm like, Adam, wow. When you're on stage, you're like so different. You control everything. He goes, when I'm on stage, I get to do the things that I can't do off stage. And everything belongs to me. I'm in control, you know, and they're there to listen to me. And the same thing. So maybe you got it from me. I don't know. But that was it. Once I got up there, I realized, hey, they're there for me to listen to me. So I wasn't scared, you know. And talking to trainees, I think it had a big impact on them, and it felt good. It felt really, really good. I didn't give money. I didn't give them anything. I gave them an intangible, which is the most wonderful thing.
It's even more than money. That's what I'm saying when I talk about mentorship. Certain things you cannot buy. That's why when I work with people who decide on their careers in the United States or they're changing their careers, I always say, go to a retired professional in this industry and talk to him or her.
Absolutely.
That's the true source.
Absolutely. Listen, here's another interesting part. So one of my trips some years ago, probably 10 years ago, maybe longer, I went to LA to visit my two sons. They both live in Los Angeles. As a matter of fact, no, only my oldest was there. My youngest was still in Chicago. And we play basketball. You know, my sons and I play basketball. It's, you know, what we enjoy. And we went to an outdoor park with a couple of friends and we played. So this young black kid came over and goes, hey, can I play with you all? I said, sure, come on. Must have been 16 years old. Good looking boy, had a smile on him. So I wore a t-shirt, it said Army on it. And I got it from my nephew who was in the Army for a while and stationed in Germany. And he brought a few t-shirts and he gave it to me and my sons, whatever. And I still have the t-shirts and I wear them. So I wore it playing basketball. And he looked at me, he goes, Army, did you go to the Army? I said, no, I didn't. I told the story. I said, why you ask? He goes, I'm thinking of joining the Army. What do you think? That's what he said to me. The 16-year-old black kid. He goes, I'm like, I don't even know this kid. So afterward, we sat down on the park bench and said, listen, I said, I don't know what to tell you. I've never been in the Army. I really don't know the answer. I said, but here's the best thing I could tell you. I said, every decision you have to make in life, a big decision, get informed. Get informed. Learn about it. Search it. Research it. Know what it's all about. What are you getting yourself into? And then decide if you want to get in or not. And he looked at me and he nodded his head. He goes, get informed. Wow, that's really good. Thank you. And I'm looking at this kid. I'm like, this young man probably doesn't have anybody to help him out. This young man has nobody to turn to and ask, you know, something simple or difficult. And it's sad. And I looked at my two sons afterwards. I said, you know, I said, this is sad. I said, I'm your dad. You can ask me anything and you do. And I'm there for you. This guy doesn't have that, it seems like, you know? Because there's a lot of young men like that, you know? And I always used to say that to my sons because I want them to appreciate things that people take for granted. Not everybody grows up with a father, sometimes not with a mother, you know? Sometimes it's a difficult, you follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, that story I tell to everybody, I almost forgot because it touched my heart. I still see this young man in my eyes. Every detail of his features, it's everything, you know, his eyes, his hair color, a little bit, you know, brownish, reddish, and good looking boy, about 6 feet tall, fit, you know, and just wanted to learn. He was lost.
And you also learned something big from this young lad. I'm sure it was an experience for you as well.
For me.
And you are just echoing my feelings. When I was thinking about starting a podcast and I asked myself, why would I do it? What can I bring to the audience out there? People listen to this all over the world. And one of the things that I told to myself is that people need to hear, people need to know. And sometimes kids are not very close to the parents, or like you say, they don't have a father. I grew up, I didn't know my father. And my mom, she was everything for me, but I also know that I couldn't share certain things with her because of many reasons, right? And this platform is, first of all, the opportunity to share a story and to bring it to the world. And hopefully the right person will hear it at the right time when he or she needs the advice. And that will be the encouragement and motivation for that person.
Yeah, one thing
you said it.
One thing you're doing, you're actually fulfilling your dream. You know, what you're doing now is fulfilling something for yourself as well. Yes, you're doing it for others, totally. But you're doing it for yourself also. Whatever we do for others, but we do it for ourselves too. You know,
absolutely.
It's not a selfish thing. It's not what I'm saying, you know, but, and you're fulfilling that need that you have. Okay. At the same time, that need is to have possibly a positive impact on others. And if it affects one person or two only positively, well, that's okay.
That's a victory.
Right. Right. More great, you know, but absolutely. Yeah. Communication, today's generation, the communication is horrible. Is it because of the cell phones and the texting? I think so. But, you know, I don't know if there's a science to it. But they don't want to communicate. And I'm not trying to bash young people, but they really don't communicate.
It's
it drives
true.
Me crazy. People don't communicate. And also, there needs to be respect. Because if you have respect, you listen. If you disrespect, you won't listen. And it, you know, and if you listen, what do you have to lose? Nothing. Nothing. Just a little time. But you've got everything to gain. You know, we used to have, when I was a broker, mutual fund wholesalers would come around, have a lunch meeting, and they would try to pitch their product and what have you. And there was all these meetings. Every week, there was meetings. Anyway, what a waste of time. But I always just say to my peers, so listen. Every time we have a meeting, there's one thing that I hear that I can take with. Everything else is garbage. But if I hear one thing, one little thing that makes me think differently or create something, you know, that I didn't think about before, yeah. It's a win. It's a
Absolutely.
Win.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One thing. You're not going to walk out, oh, I got a dozen things out of it. No. You're never going to get three. But if you get one, you're lucky.
So
you know?
True.
And
so
you
true.
Always get one. So if you listen... You never know. Now you talk to them, it's like they don't want to listen to you. You know, they know everything. And it's part of society and education process's fault. You got to beat it into our heads. You know, that this is how it should be. I'll tell you a very interesting, unrelated story very quickly. When I was little, there was a big pitch here in the United States, in Chicago, in the United States, okay? People used to throw garbage on the street, on the sidewalk, okay? Yeah, you'd had lunch and you'd throw it, you know. In Israel, they still do. You know how we beat it? I'll tell you how we beat it. They put big metal garbage cans all over the city, and there was commercials every moment on TV. And they used like a bear, a caricature of a bear, you know. And what was it? Pitch. Something, the word pitch was used to pitch your garbage into whatever you have, into the garbage, not to the street. And it kept playing over and over. It was like brainwashing. And after a while, you did it. Why? Because it's all you heard. And it made you feel guilty if you didn't. And the city became clean. The city became cleaner for that. The city became cleaner for that. I swear to God, I remember the commercials. It was like constant beating the drum. Pitch your garbage into the garbage. Pitch your garbage into the garbage. Like, oh, yeah, yeah. But it made, now, do you see people throwing garbage in the streets, on the sidewalk? No. You don't see that.
They definitely keep it clean.
Right. Nobody, you know, nobody walks around and just throws their garbage on the sidewalk. Nobody does that because we have been trained as a society. And I said to my cousin in Israel, they should do a big campaign in Israel. Because you guys are throwing it on the beach and everything all over. What is this? This is not nice, you know. As a matter of fact, I'm going to talk to them about that again and have them try to start a campaign in Israel. If not, I'm going to communicate to the Israeli council and say, listen, I got an idea for you guys, okay? I swear to God. Because it worked here. It worked here. So it's all about communication. It truly is, you know. We lost that. We're disconnected.
I agree with you 100%, and I'm a big believer in communication, and I love communication, and I believe in a certain flow. I just enjoy it. Before, it wasn't like this, and you know why? Because of my culture, because this is something that we don't do in Russia. We don't talk to people, and we don't listen to people. We talk to people to interrupt. That's how simply I can describe my culture.
Are you sure that's only Russian? Because the Israelis and Jews do that too.
Many, you know, many cultures do. I hear this from many cultures I work with. And I had a hard time with this, to be honest with you. When I came here and I talked to that person, that lady, and I was actually talking and I was out of words. And in my brain, I go like, okay, interrupt me, say something. But she did not. She was literally waiting for me to finish what I wanted to say, and then she started to talk.
My brain was waiting
for this interruption. I wanted this because this is how it's wired. And I had to really rewire my brain. I had to really to become patient when I talk to people. And you know what changed my attitude towards listening? That person said, we have two ears and one mouth for a reason. So that's why we should listen more than we speak.
You know, it's interesting.
And that changed everything for me.
Interesting you say that. Along the same lines, I tend to talk more than I listen. And I know that. And I have to be conscious about that. I get that from my mom. My dad didn't speak much. My mom spoke forever. She's still speaking. As a matter of fact, when my dad went back to Israel to visit my uncle, her brother, says to my dad, so how's Jackie? Still talking?
That's her business card, right?
Right.
That's
right.
Her image.
So the point I was trying to make, what you just said, okay, about listening. So early on in my stockbroker career at Merrill Lynch, one of my colleagues said to me, he said he was going to succeed because he's a good listener. That's what he said to me. He goes,
that's important.
I have something that most people don't have. I'm a good listener. And I'm like, interesting. He said that. Wow, what a statement to make. And I'm like, I'm not a good listener. Okay. So I better, you know, I just learned something. I swear to God, it was like an awakening. And the point was, so That was big, because I'm not a good listener. So I try now to be careful. And also, I always said for decades, I said to people, listen, I know you run into all sorts of people in life. And some people you think maybe they're not so bright. And, you know, they're not, this guy's not smart. But you always listen, because you never know what you might hear from that person.
Thank you for saying
one word of wisdom can change everything for you.
Yes.
And even a guy that you don't think is so smart will say one word of wisdom. So listen, don't dismiss them right away.
So true.
You know, when I was training at Merrill Lynch, they're going to send me to New York to train. I'm like, I don't want to go to New York. They all party over there. I want to study. I'm not going. I don't want to party. And my manager's like, really? Everybody wants to go to New York. What are you talking about? I said, no. I want to stay in Evanston. That was the other station. He goes, okay. I'm sure I can find somebody who'll switch with you. And I did. I wanted to study. I didn't want to party. So when I was training, there was about 30 other people there from different offices. And I was kind of an oddball. And they looked at me kind of funny. I know that. They didn't have a lot of respect for me, maybe my intelligence and so forth. And I could tell. I'm like, that's okay. It's my way. And I'm not here to impress them. Okay. And after I started production and became successful, they all called me. Oh, what are you doing? How is it? You know, what is it that you're doing that's different? I'm like, I don't know, you know. But I'm like, wow, you kind of look down at me like I'm an idiot, you know, during a training program. But now all of a sudden you're calling me, okay?
So that's what happens, Ron, when you become successful.
Yeah, but that's okay. That's okay.
That
I'm glad they called. You always listen to, I listen to young people. Just because they're younger doesn't mean they don't know anything. They might say something that I,
absolutely,
you know, trigger,
yeah,
you know.
And I so agree with you when you say there might be that one thought, one idea, one word that you needed to hear that time. It will change the entire life sometimes. I've had those experiences in my life. One word, that's all it takes.
Anya, this is what happened to me sitting in a third desk of the lobby at Bank Leumi, the Israeli bank, and Ronnie, the guard, standing behind me.
Right.
All he said to me is, what are you going to do with your life? And I didn't like, what are you talking about? Leave me alone. You know, what are you, an idiot? You know, and just dismiss him. He's the security guard. What does he know? He's just a security guard. You know, I could have looked down at him, right? No, I listened. I listened. Like, what does he mean by that? And he got me to buy that book and I listened and it changed. Now, maybe 1,000 other people buy the book and it will not change your life. Maybe it won't, you know, but that's okay. That's okay. You know, you pass it along. And if it triggers something for somebody, great, you know, but at least they tried, you know? So yeah, I listened to this guy and what you just said, one thought can change your whole life. And it did.
Totally. And I tell you this, those security guards or my concierge downstairs, they're the smartest and wisest people. Because when you think about the amount of people they deal on a daily basis with,
right,
that's
right,
amazing. And they, yes, they hear different stories. They use different skills. They're great,
yes,
communicators. They're great,
right,
problem solvers. That's
right.
Why those people, you might think they're small, but not really. They're very smart.
Everybody's got something to offer.
Exactly.
Everybody has something to offer, and it's okay to listen. So, yeah, you know, I enjoy reminiscing.
I want to ask you this question, and that's going to be another reflection, I guess, from you. What advice would you give to that little Ron when he just came back to the United States and he wanted to start his American dream, living his American dream in this country?
What advice I would have given the 11-year-old boy that came here?
Yes. Would you do anything differently? Would you keep it the same? So many people listen to this podcast, and I don't want to say they want the recipe, but they want to hear what would be the right thing to do, maybe, or a good thing to do when they come to this country.
For me, at that time and situation, would have been, you do belong here, don't be too nervous about it, and you are part of the system. Don't worry, and don't be nervous about that, and just carry on the way you would carry on wherever you're at, Israel or what have you. And don't be on edge. Don't be anxious. Just take a deep breath, calm down. Not everything is going to be perfect. Not everybody's going to be perfect, but sometimes imperfect people we run across to in imperfect situations makes you stronger, makes you figure things out. Because if everything is easy, your brain don't develop. If everything is easy, yeah, then you don't have innovation. You don't develop courage, you know, charisma. So sometimes it's okay to be in a difficult situation, because there's positives to that. So don't be too anxious. Look at everything. Whatever happens for the best. And I learned that the biggest example for me was being turned down for a job as a financial advisor so often. And I'm like, what is going on? And that really hit me. But it was done on purpose. So I end up interviewing at the Northbrook office, which ended up being a palace. You follow me? So
yes.
It wasn't failing in the other interviews. It was the path. It was the road that I was supposed to walk down. It was part of it to reach that door to open the rest of what I wanted to achieve. So, you know, that's the advice. I was a little too worried about everything then.
Just let it go.
Yeah. 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 And then if you're more relaxed and everybody's around you, won't look at you as an oddball. Maybe I kind of created that of myself being a little anxious and nervous, you know? As a matter of fact, that young boy that came with the other family, he was much smoother and cooler than I was. Honestly. And I'm like, you know what? I should be like that. What's wrong with, you know, don't be, you know, he's like, just brushes everything off. Not too much fazed him. Maybe too much fazed me, you know? Don't let it faze you. Don't let it faze you.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed your story, and I feel like I was submerged today in the real American dream story, coming here by boat almost. The half of the journey was by boat. And then reading a book and seeing something bigger in this life and becoming bigger, that's the true American dream. And thank you for sharing this, Ron. It's so powerful. And I feel like there is more for you. I feel like
you
want to accomplish more, and you want to do more with your life and with life of other people around you. And I think it's a wonderful cause to continue. And it's a drive. I know that you are a driven person.
Yes, you have to have it. It's got to be in your subconscious. And you got to create that in your subconscious, you know? But very important to be driven. That's how the world advances. Innovation is only because of people's drive. Think about it.
So you know? True. Yes.
Yeah, that's how the world progresses. You know, people being driven to create, to do.